years to commit and go to yeshiva. A rare privilege and really an honor and pleasure to introduce the speaker this evening, who is the Soloveitchik in several places, but points out that the definition of a Rebbe Mufhak is not necessarily gauged by the quantitative amount that one learns. The Chazal give the definition of a Rebbe Mufhak, someone who is a person who is a more than just someone who you have learned from, but rather someone who you owe a great deal of debt, of gratitude, and honor, as someone that you've learned Rov Chachmatcha, the majority of your wisdom. And this, the Rav claims, is not to be viewed merely as quantitative. He's speaking about his own father, that he said he didn't learn most of what he had learned from his father in terms of sitting next to him, the Chavruta, but rather in terms of the Derech HaLimud that he had gained from him. And basically everything that he had learned after that point, he had learned to a large extent because of what he had learned from his father. Professor Karmi is, for me personally, one of those Rebbei Mufakim that have come across, that I have come across in my lifetime. Not only for the few years when I was, going back now almost 25 years, when I was in NYU and was a student of his in various courses. Not only because of the time, the hours spent on the fifth floor of the library, which he famously spends time with Talmidim, just speaking and giving forth from his wisdom, but basically having gained from him a certain Derech HaLimud in terms of approach to Tanakh. He's now the chair of the Bible department as well as the Jewish philosophy department at Yeshiva College. But also, not only a Derech HaLimud, but an approach of a person who is a modern Orthodox academic scholar, a person who is very, very much grounded in Torah, in Mesorah, and nevertheless, and these are things that he's written about as well, nevertheless, has a very clear view of the world, the academic world outside, and understanding the limitations and understanding the challenges of what it means to be an Orthodox, a Shomer Torah Mitzvah scholar, and at the same time being a scholar of the first rank. And that is something that every time that I look at a Pasuk in Chumash, and every time that I look at a perek and think in terms of understanding it from different vantage points, so there's no question in my mind that from that perspective Rav Karmi is very much a Rebbe Mufhak of mine. I would recommend at this point that just that you should know, you can even jot it down, there is a recently Atid put up on its website a collection of the essays of Rav Karmi. He is currently also the editor of Tradition. He's been that for the last few years. And you can have easy access to a tremendous wealth of knowledge both in terms of both in the areas of Tanakh as well in Jewish philosophy. It's very much a great pleasure and honor to be able to present you with Rabbi Kahn.
Those occasions when I'm in a soil, I do visit various shivot and speak, and given that my time is pressured when I'm here, the function of where I speak depends to a very large extent on my personal relationship with the Rebbeim in those places. And I have very fond memories of the years, the mid-1980s, when Sussman was an important part of my intellectual world. I also the series debts, Robert Abner, I don't see here now, but who in those days was older than me, and probably still older than me, and who did for me the things that older people are supposed to do for younger people, and facilitating their maturation and moving the way ahead. They're very important debts. One person older, one person younger. And I won't say more about it, but I mean very profoundly. When I present you now, I've gone through several Mahadurot in the last couple of weeks. The first time I presented a substantial part of it in about 5 to 10 minutes, Friday night in Brooklyn. Fortunately or unfortunately, I had student over Shabbos, and by the time we reviewed what I had said between the old Shabbos and Maariv, by 1 o'clock in the morning, this had grown into something much more substantial, and I last presented this in Beit Shemesh a few days ago. It had grown to 2 hours, where we're going to go somewhere in the middle now. I want to just sit down and read a few lines of Ramban. I think it's one of the sad things about how we study Tanakh is that people are running to find this new book and that new book, and each new book has some kind of cleverness and acuteness to it, and we forget, and the Rav used to emphasize in Gemara that you should learn the major Rishonim line by line instead of trying to collect piles and piles of shitot and books. In Chumash, it's true as well. In certain Mefarshim, you want to learn what Tanakh is about, what Chumash is about. You take certain Mefarshim and you really work with them line by line, you will develop Derech HaLimud. And you know those Yishonim well also. If you hapka from one Achron to another, you may not get it that readily. And the Ramban is certainly very much the top of those Yishonim who should be studied. The background, and I'm giving away the fact that this was sort of prepared a couple of weeks ago, maybe a little bit stale to you, but you know, Chumash is not a newspaper, it doesn't get, it remains fresh even after 2 weeks. It's well known that in going through the Makot, there are different patterns that can be discerned. And one pattern that has been discerned, has been talked about, is a pattern of triads within the Makot. Even Haggadah, he said, the Tzach, Hadash, Be'achav, I think Rabbi Yehuda was not simply doing this in order to help people memorize, to make a song out of it, but the idea that each three sets of Makot go together. And it's been noted that the first two of these makot involve paro being warned, whereas the third does not involve a warning. And when I was, you know, very young, I could give you a whole list of shitot. I was 12 years old, I could give you a whole list of shitot that every different explanation has been given. I only want to discuss two now, and I've forgotten some of the others, and I want to focus understanding rather than just enumerating two approaches to this question. One approach, which is popular among some later Ashkenazic Rishonim, Rashbam, Chizkuni, so forth, and it's picked up later by the Sfarno, would hold that the first two, Paro is warned, because it's appropriate to warn somebody before you punish him. The third is pure punishment. The third does not require warning, because the third is the punishment for his not having listened the first two times. And therefore, Kinim is no hatra, Shechin is no hatra, Choshech is no hatra. Whether or not the Ramban knew about the Shita is historically a question. If you're sitting in the Beit Midrash, you don't really care, did the Ramban know that Shita, didn't know that Shita, but historically it really is some curious question. Did he know it and ignore it, or did he simply didn't penetrate to northern France, to northern Spain? The Ramban has another approach to the question. And I want to start by looking at that. This is halfway down. I mean, I asked him to Xerox the whole Ramban, because I didn't have Ramban in front of me, so do the whole thing. But halfway down, Masha Amar Rabbi Abraham Ibn Ezra, Ki Moshe Lo Hodiya Makat Kinim. Moshe omitted the lice. The Aharon demonstrated the act. He used the mate just as he did with the Shechin, where they threw the soot up into the air. There was no hatra. His answer is different from the Ashkenazic answer. The Ramban's answer is that hatra is necessary only regarding those makot that actually threaten death. So where do we have hatra? Dam. Dam, you can give another reason, because Dam was the very first one, so you have to have Atra. Tzfardea, the Ramban gives you an argument, Tzfardea actually could lead to fatality. Arov and Dever, again, these are animal diseases, could easily spread to the human being. Barad, Arbe, can destroy the crops and lead to famine. So in those cases, you need Atra, because it's a matter of life and death. Kinim, Shechin, and Choshech do not present the same problem. Lice, and I know those of you who are into the history of medicine will say, what about typhus? But the Ramban is not interested in typhus right now. The average lousy person doesn't die. It's just annoying, it's irritating. Shechin, you have a skin disease. It can be very embarrassing. The Khartoumim were unable to stand for pot. It was embarrassing. It comes with skin diseases. It doesn't kill. So the Ramban is making that distinction between the lethal makot and the non-lethal makot. But that really leaves me with the question, why should there be such a difference? Why do we have a satra to begin with? Why warn somebody? A person deserves punishment. You punish them. Why do you have to warn them? The Ramban says something about that. He says, "Hakol rachamim ito ba'adam." The warning is a manifestation of rachamim, mercy. You have mercy on somebody, you have mercy for somebody, you care about somebody, you warn them before you smite them. And now the Ramban gives proof for this from Pasukim Yecheskel. He actually could have used two Pasukim in Yecheskel. The same discussion appears in Yecheskel Perek Gimel and in Yecheskel Perek Lamed Gimel. the quotation in the printed Ramban is not exactly like either one, but it's a lot closer to the one in Lamed Gimel. The one in Gimel, the Rabban Shem tells the Navi Yecheskel, he tells him, you are a watchman for Klal Yisrael. Your job is to warn them. When I say to the Rasha, you will die, and you did not warn the Rasha in my name, the Rasha will die, and you will be held responsible. And if you did warn the Rasha, and the Rasha didn't listen to you anyway, the Rasha dies, but you are in the clear. That's what you have in Perek Gimel. In Perek Lamed Gimel, it offhand sounds similar, but it's a little bit different. In Lamed Gimel, which is very close to the climax of the Navi's career, the Pasuk says, God says to the Navi, he says, tell the people, when there's a land that is in danger of war, the people will appoint a watchman, and then he goes through the same kind of thing. If the watchman knows what's happening, he fails to warn them, they die, and he is held responsible. If he warns them and they didn't listen to him, they die, but he is in the clear. And then God continues and says, Atah ben Adam, you, Tzofet Teichel Beit Yisrael, you really do have that status of the Tzofet, and you will hear what I say, you'll repeat it, and again, when I say about the Rasha, you will die, and you didn't speak to him, and so on and so forth. So Ramban mentions that those Pesukim in Yecheskel. Ramban says, the role of the Navi, we see in Yecheskel, the role of the Navi is to warn people. And likewise, the role of Moshe vis-a-vis Paro is to warn him. So therefore, Moshe is obligated to warn Paro. And the Ramban continues and says that if Moshe fails to warn Paro, Moshe is responsible for failing to have warned him. Therefore, Ramban repeats himself. Lo hitrabo bikinim v'lo b'shchina v'choshech rak v'dever b'abur shehu mitah. Now my question comes back again. The Ramban said that the purpose of Hatra is rachamim. He said it. The Ramban says what we're talking about vis-a-vis Paro is the same thing we talked about regarding Yecheskel talk with the people. And you notice, interestingly, that according to this, Moshe had the same kind of responsibility to Paro, to a guy, that Yecheskel would have to a Jewish audience. Not taking much out of it, just worth noticing. It's rachamim, and God is, if a Navi has the word of God, he has to deliver it to people. So the question again is, why only in the case of death? Rabban's proof may be from Yecheskel, because Yecheskel says, Mot Tamut. Death, but why not? Something else. It's really rachamim. Let's warn people about other things. Two possibilities, Misvara. One possibility is to say that really the Navi should warn people about a lot of things. The only thing is that in terms of imposing upon the Navi those responsibilities and treating the Navi as if he is complicit in the death of the person, there's a limit how much you're going to chep the Navi. Financial advisor, your broker, and the situation you could end up losing hundreds of thousands of dollars, and I failed to warn you, then I'm really responsible for doing something terrible. If it's a matter of $100 here, $100 there, then if the broker doesn't get on the phone, and doesn't get an email, and doesn't run after me, and doesn't insist I should call him back from Eretz Yisrael, no matter what the hour of the day, if it's couple hundred dollars, doesn't matter. I'm not going to hold him responsible. I'm not having him punished. We'll not report him. We'll not stop using him. It's simply, really, he should be warning me about everything. But certain things are just too insignificant. It's like a shavat pruta of inconvenience. From that point of view, I could say that warning somebody to prevent, to avoid having a plague of lice, it's a mere bag of shells, and who cares? You know, not that important. Death, famine, that's the kind of thing, you know, once you're dead, you can't really recover from it that easily. That's real. However, if this svara was correct, that's no reason for Moshe not to warn Paro. It would be a reason for not holding Moshe responsible for not warning Paro. But it's no reason for God to tell Moshe, just go ahead and do the Makkah without giving Paro a warning. So that svara, I think, does not explain the situation we have here. So the second possibility, which in certain ways is much more radical, is to say that regarding certain types of warning, there really is no obligation to warn a person. Yecheskel says, mot tamut, it's a matter of life and death. It's not a matter of life and death. If it's a less important thing, you have lice, you'll recover, the lice will go away after a few days, you'll be back to normal. You have boils, a few days will go away, you will outgrow it. So there really is no obligation. Mushroom of a dome, eh? Then we deal with you have a child. Child does something foolish. If something foolish, like putting his hand in the fire, if you fail to pull his hand out, you are fully responsible for what happens. Consider you abusive, so forth. If it's something where, let's say, a child overeats and has an upset stomach the next day, you might say, look, human beings have free will. Even children are on the road to having free will. And from an educational point of view, there's no permanent harm done with an upset stomach. The child learns a lesson, and that's the end of it. So I'm suggesting, yes, that would really be the svara. When it comes to death, then the Navi has to give the warning. If he fails to give the warning, he is responsible. If it's simply a matter of lice, the Navi does not have responsibility. Even l'chatchila. It's not, he's not punished for doing it. Don't call him abusive. But he's really allowed to let nature take its course. I'm just trying to understand the simple, what the Ramban might mean here. Now we come to the second half, the second half of the Ramban that I want to look at here. Ramban goes on and says, "V'al derech ha-pshat." As was said before, it was not necessarily pshat. Hayav eitzei tamlachim. This happened, the hatra was given, at a time when the king went out to the water, lishtashea alamayim. Ramban posits, when the pasuk says, hinei yotzei hamayma, that it means that Paro was going to have fun in the water. He's going to enjoy himself there. Why does Ramban call this pshat? Because Ramban is apparently excluding which view? Rashi. According to Rashi, Paro is going to the water because he wants to hide his human vulnerabilities. doesn't want people to know that he goes to the bathroom the same way everybody else goes to the bathroom. Ramban does not read it that way, because Ramban wants to emphasize that this Hatra is taking place in public and that the Egyptians witness is happening. Tzivakash Baruch Hu Moshe She'elech Sham V'atam Kibadam. In the dam, Moshe goes to Paro when he's going to the water. God wanted that Moshe should do it in Paro's face in the presence of everybody to make it clear that Moshe was not intimidated by Paro. Yamod kenedo biyad rama. Kein makat arov. Arov is which number?
Four.
So it's the first of the triad. Dam is the first of the first triad, and arov is the first of the second triad. It also says, itasev pnei paro in yosei amayma. And the barad, which is the first of the third triad, he gets saved with Nei Paro. There's no water mentioned. It says we see already Nei Paro goes together with the water. So the first three of the triad, Moshe confronts Paro in the presence of the Egyptians. Kiaro v'habarad asher bahena mita v'haonish l'bnei adam ratzakash baruch shiel inei kol ha'am. The Arov and the Barad, which endanger all human beings, God wanted the warning to be done in the presence of all the Egyptians. People go with him, the journalists come to have impromptu interview with him. If the people know what's coming upon them, they may cry out, and in crying out, they will cause Paro perhaps to relent. They'll try to pressure Paro. And if the people do not plead with Paro, they're responsible because they've seen what's coming, and they're culpable. So the first three, in each triad, the first one of the Makot, the people are involved. And now that means the second one of the triad, Moshe warns Paro without the people being present. And the third of the triad, as we have seen, is done without a warning at all. Why is it that regarding the second and third Makot in each triad, Moshe does not warn all the Egyptians? Until now, we were only talking about why in the third Makot of the triad, Paro is not warned at all. There's no Hatra. Now, the Ramban kept on talking, we have a whole bunch of additional problems. Namely, why? What's the difference between the first of the triad and the second of the triad, between the first and the second, the fourth and the fifth, the seventh and the eighth? This question that Ramban is clearly raising, but he doesn't answer at all. Among the Rishonim, the Abarbanel gives the answer that I find most interesting, most plausible. According to the Abarbanel, the goal is to warn Paro. The first time, again, the people are present. The second time, the goal is to warn Paro when the people are not present, because if you're trying to communicate with Paro, sometimes if the people are around him, that will not be the best way to get through to him. You know many people, if you challenge them in public, they will stare you down, they'll ignore you. If you speak to them in private, when people aren't around, we're not going to lose face, then you may make progress with them. So Rabbanu says you have that variation, the first to second. The first time, the idea is to confront them publicly. The second time, to try the option of maybe getting to him in private. The Rambam does not say this, and we have no reason to assume that Rambam either adopted. But if he didn't adopt, the question really is, how does he differentiate between the first member of the triad and the second member of the triad? Bishar makot dai b'hatarat ha-malach. It's enough to just warn the king. He doesn't give you a good reason for warning only the king, but he says it's enough if you just warn the king. Sufficient, you're yoked, say. And anyway, no, may give you a reason, dafka, why you would not have the people present. Okay, ne'emar b'hem bo'el paro she'avol he'chalo. V'lo yizkir b'kinim u'v'shchin kein. Now the question is, why did the Torah not say anything like this in the kinim and shchin? Now the first time you read it, you think that Ramban answered that question already, right? Ramban said in the kinim and the arov, there was no hatra because it's not a matter of life and death. And we tried to explain that pshat as best as we could. Now that he has this additional discussion, it seems he's coming back to the same question, giving a different answer. And you wonder, is Ramban the same Ramban? Or did he sort of veer off into a new direction and he, so to speak, forgot or set aside everything he said before? In a way, in the Rav Shir, sometimes, you know, develop his whole mahalach and then switch gear and do everything over from a different point of view. So, it could be that Ramban just forgot what he said before and started a new approach. I would prefer to say that Ramban is consistent with what he said before. I'll try to explain that in a moment. Lo yizkir b'kinim v'shchin kein b'avur shutzach Aharon lakot be'afar. In kinim and shchin, Aharon had to use dirt to create the lice, to create the soot, to put the soot up, to come down in the form of boils. Bechal ha-malach she'en sham afar. Moshe and Aaron could not go to the palace because the palace did not have the dirt floor. So he had to do it elsewhere. Which does not connect at all with what we were discussing before. Kein usak Moshe lezrok upeach ha-shamayma v'ine asu elu ha-shtayim b'fnei paro b'yoto b'chatzar ginat b'tan ha-malach o kayotzei bo. Now here we notice something else. We notice that in the kinim and the shchin, we are told this was done in the presence of Paro. It's something you wouldn't necessarily get from the pasuk. In the pasuk, you either have warning or punishment. If I take the Rashbam of Chizkuni's approach, the third and sixth makkah does not require Paro's attendance at all. It's a punishment. He had his chance before, and he blew his chance. Why in the third and the sixth? The Ramban says it was done in his presence. Why did the Ramban want to emphasize that? What is gained by emphasizing that? I think what is gained is as follows. In all three cases, Paro is part of the process. Even in the third and the sixth, Paro was there. So tell me, if he's there, isn't that a kind of warning? If you do it behind somebody's back, you say there's no warning. But again, if I tell you that if you hand in a poorly written report, I will tear it up. That's a warning. If you give me the poorly written report, I'm standing in your presence. I don't warn you. I just start ripping. I'm communicating the same thing. I'm telling you I'm not going to rip it. I'm communicating the same displeasure. What's the difference between hatra and a kind of hatra by action rather than hatra by words? I think there is a very important difference. When I warn somebody with words, I'm inviting some kind of response. When I'm simply acting, I'm turning my face away, I'm just doing it, I'm not telling you what I'm doing, I'm really not inviting any kind of response. So we go over what we've got in the Ramban here. We had that first mahalach in the Ramban, What bothers Ramban at that point is the question of why the third, sixth, ninth Sunnah of Atra. The answer he gave focused on the difference between the threat of death and the non-threat of death, threat of something else. And we tried to understand the question as best as we could. Then, the next part of the Ramban, the trigger question, what's really, really bothering the Ramban is why this is done in the presence of Paro and the people. And the explanation was, well, the people have to get their warning as well. Then we've got the question we raised that the Ramban himself did not raise, and what's the difference between the first of the triad, the second of the triad. Then when we come to the third triad, it's the third member of each triad, to the Kinim and the Arov and the Ishchin, there the Ramban is not asking the question he asked in the first half. The question in the first half is, why don't you have Atra? In the second half, the question Ramban is asking is, why is it that the Hatra, that the action is done in the way that it's done? Not in Paro's palace, but in some other place. He's asking a very different question. Again, according to both views, Paro is aware of what's happening. He's being confronted. The difference is, in the first two sets, the warning is a warning that invites dialogue. It's a warning that involves words. Whereas in the third, he's simply acting unilaterally, and Paro can get the message. He's being communicated with, but he's really not invited to respond back. I wanted to sketch a couple of other implications of what we discussed here that we want to pursue beyond this. One point, which is in the Xerox, as I was reading this, I said that Ramban is using as an analogy for his argument the Pesukim in Yecheskel. It talks Yecheskel's function as an Avi. Even though some could very well say, you know, what Yecheskel's talking about is only for an Avi to Jews, and that, I mean, not Jews, and Ramban ignores that. Ramban is universalist in this. I asked myself, why does Ramban not mention Ochiach Tochiach? It's a general obligation to everybody to warn somebody away from sin. So if the purpose of the Hatra is to give him a warning, Ramban could have used Ochiach Tochiach. So why doesn't he use Ochiach Tochiach? There, I think the pasuk is very clear. Ochiach Tochiach, lo tisna et achicha bilvavecha. That pasuk applies only to a Jew. Why does it apply only to a Jew? Now, if you look at the Ramban that I'm not reading now, look carefully at what Ramban says. The Ramban first quotes Onkelos. And the Ramban's interpretation of Onkelos, yeah, I said it was not going to read it, and now I'm wide to you. If I can find it. Yeah. The Ramban quotes Onkelos as the fourth line, meaning the second line of a second paragraph. So according to Ramban's Pshat in Onkelos, it's not the only Pshat in Onkelos. You read the Gavsi Hoffman, he claims that Ramban misread Onkelos here. But according to Ramban's reading of Onkelos, Onkelos really interpreted exactly the way that Ramban was interpreting Pesuk in Yecheskel. I mean, if you fail to give tochacha, lo tisa alav chet, if you fail to do tochacha, you will bear the sin. You will be responsible for the sin. If you do give him tochacha, then lo tisa alav chet, then you will not be held responsible. That's Ramban's reading of Onkelos. And if that's the correct reading of Onkelos, and Onkelos, according to Onkelos, really The Ramban's Pshat in Moshe is the same as Unkel's Pshat in Uchem Techa. However, the Ramban himself understood Uchem Techa differently. According to the Ramban, the reason, the meaning of Uchem Techa is that you should restore your relationship with that person. Don't be angry with him. Say what you've got to say. And Loti Salav Chet, don't bear a grudge against him. Clearly, for Ramban, what he's talking about in Shmuel, he's talking about Vayikra, are two very different things. In Shmuel, in Vayikra, he's talking about a principle of interpersonal relations that would apply probably among Jews within the community, of not bearing a grudge. In Shmuel, what he's talking about is a function of the Navi, for the purpose of rachamim. Which leads me to the last point. There are many more, but we will not be getting the two-hour version. Leads me to another point. If this analysis is correct, then, in effect, the Navi's bearing responsibility is a din in his being a Navi. Part of being a Navi is taking that kind of responsibility. The job of the Navi is to communicate God's will to people, not just to help people do tshuva, but to communicate God's will to the people. The Navi, in a certain way, is not just doing God's work, but he is directly delegated in representing God. I think it's a very radical way of interpreting what a Navi is doing. And a Navi is not just somebody who gives musar, because God told him to do it. He is somebody who really is speaking in God's voice. And there I might very well say that the idea of Nevuah being Rachamim is that even when God is punishing Paro, it is very important there should be a warning, because by giving Paro the warning, by giving any target of Nevuah the warning, you are telling that person that the Rabbanu Shalom's outlook is really an outlook of rachamim, that God is not punishing out of some vengefulness against the human race, but even in punishment, there is a face that is initiating dialogue. I think that is why the Ramban used the Pasuk Dafka in Yecheskel Lamed Gimel. In Pergimel Yecheskel, the pasuk is about punishment, about the Navi being held responsible. In Lamed Gimel, the pasuk continues after the part that I read. It continues Kiloach Botzumotamet, that the reason that you have this entire institution of the Navi with all responsibility attaches to the Navi is because the Ribbono Shel Olam wants to be known as Baal Rachamim, even when there's rebuke and chastisement, even when it's punishment. Sorry, I abridged the last points. There's one with the Haskell here as well. We are not Nevi'im, we're not B'nai Nevi'im. We have the Chiyuv Tuchacha, along the lines Ramban and others written about. But at a certain level, we as individuals, if we're not Nevi'im, we still are people who speak for God. Ben Torah acts a certain way. People, how else are people going to know Dvar Hashem? Well, some people know Dvar Hashem because they study Chumash. But the people, they don't study Chumash. Even they take Torah for Bagrut. They treat it the way you treat any other study, and they memorize, and they, you know, you just want to pass the exam. So, you know, Torah is communicate, not just by reading, by personal communication as well. And it's very important for us to know if we're presenting the Ribbono Shel Olam, even if we're speaking words of punishment, even and words that are negative, we have to communicate that sense of Loch Bot Vemotameh, that sense that should always be warning, there should always be what the Ramban calls Dachamim. I think I've used as much time as I want to use for lecture. And precisely because it was very rapid and part of the exposition, there may be questions, and even if I present it perfectly, there may be questions.
Two questions, two different points that you mentioned. The first is, based on the Ramban's shita here, you say that he disagrees with the notion of breaking up the makos, that the groups of three fall in order with increasing severity. That Sfardei was more severe than Dam, which is more severe than...
But he says the opposite. Say Kinim, don't threaten life. That's explicit.
That the first of each group was more. Okay. And the second question is, the example you gave when you were comparing the warning is to a child who's about to stick their hand in the fire, or a child who gets a stomachache. You think that the notion here is talking in terms of that the punishment is a form of consequence, or that it's some form of atonement?
According to the Ramban, I don't know if they really have to answer that question, because it's just one more form of makah. At each one, and especially if we take the end of the Ramban, each one is a different form of communication, one which is communication public, one's communication private, and the third is the kind of communication through action, where there's no verbal communication at all. And they argue the difference, it's not the Ramban, it's me, that the difference may have to do with the degree to which you're inviting dialogue. If you adopt the other shita, I think that question will really come up. What is that third member of the triad really doing? After all, assuming you say Sfardeya is a warning, but Sfardeya is also a maka. Sfardeya is two things. It's both a warning and a maka. So why do you need that third maka? And that I don't necessarily have a really good explanation of. What is that third? I would like to think more clearly about it. What is that third element doing? Is it, well, the first stage was only a sign, and the third one is just a free makkah. It may be that you may then have to come up with some kind of theory, like what I suggest with Ramban, that there's the kind of punishment that invites dialogue and the kind of punishment that does not invite dialogue. And then, in effect, those other Rishonim, through my mediation, will end up saying the same, something similar to Ramban. But again, none of them is saying anything until I may really be trivializing them. I may be telling you something that is not really in the Ramban, but makes sense to the Ramban. And it would be more difficult to put it into the other shittos, but one should do that. Maybe. Yeah?
Does Rambam give any specific reason as to why the first and second sets of the triads were ordered the way they were? Meaning why, specifically, Moshe and Aaron were intended to confront Paro in front of a large group of people? Specifically,
well, the first one is supposed to confront a large group of people in order that those people should intercede with Paro. They should plead with him. And if they plead with him, there are two things. One, conceivably, Paro could be affected by them, although we know that he's not going to be. And secondly, the Ramban says that if they fail to intercede with Paro, they share responsibility. And I glossed over that point, but it's a very important point. The point that the Ramban is really raising here, the Rechagav, how much responsibility do people have when the king is getting them into all this trouble? King is doing all these terrible things that people end up suffering. Now, in a way, this really brings you back to the Ramban in Lech Lecha. You know which Ramban I refer to? The Ramban has a statement in Lech Lecha that if the Egyptians were acting only because God said, Kiger Zachab Erzoem Bavduminu Otam, the Egyptians were saying, Hinnich Mochen Zuman, Lekaye Mitzvat Bavanu Binu Otam, then the Egyptians would not be culpable, they would only be doing God's will. And the reason that the Egyptians are punished is because they did more than God's will. Now, if I adopt that Shita Ramban, I could ask, well, how do the Egyptians know that they did more than God's will? And the answer would be, Moshe came and said, enough already, and the Egyptians didn't protest, so that shows you that the Egyptians are responsible. It's a very good way of taking on a bunch of shita and lech lecha and putting a nice flesh and meaning on it. The only problem is that if you actually go and read the Ramban's language in lech lecha, the Ramban in lech lecha clearly is not saying what I just said. I could still say, you know, if the Ramban was revising and we were learning the Chavrusa of the Ramban might say, you know, the truth is what I said in Shmok does have something to do with what I'm saying in Breishit. Maybe. But if you actually look at his Lashon in Breishit, he clearly is talking about other ways of measuring responsibility. I think that addresses your point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if I misunderstood, but we were asked the question why it is that we use the verse, why the Ramban uses the verse in the Teskel, as opposed to the one here in Vayikra. I don't see why the answer wouldn't just be because in the Teskel, as we said, it says Motamut. It's talking specifically about death. We need that to explain why.
So he needs a pasuk in Yecheskel in order to establish not the notion of why giving musar is important, the idea of rachamim, but simply the idea of death. It's a good point. It's a good point. Now again, if I want to complicate the issue further, it is not all obvious to me that the word mavet in Yecheskel has to mean dafka death. The Radak apparently didn't learn that way. If you look at the Radak in Yecheskel Perek Yudchet, now you could tell me maybe Lamed Gimel and Yudchet are different prakim, and it's not the same thing. But in Yudchet, the Radak says, obviously we're talking about Schava Onesh in his context, it doesn't only mean death, it has to mean other things as well. And therefore Radak translates the word death as welfare, you know, as being miserable or being unhappy, etc., etc. And the question I can ask myself is, did Ramban know that Radak? Ramban clearly read Radak and Chumash, even though he never mentions Radak and Chumash. Ramban, in one place, quotes Radak's grammatical work. There's no evidence, no direct evidence, Ramban reading Radak and Vim Tuvim. It could be he didn't have it, or it could be that people haven't worked hard enough to study that. If the Ramban was aware of the Radak's position, the Ramban may really be saying, no, I'm not learning that way. I'm saying if it says motamut, it means literally motamut. And he was aware that that somebody could argue the other way. But I think you're right, that the issue of death is what interests him as a distinction, then that might be what he's after here. Even though later on he does add Inyan Rachamim, which is a different idea, which Ucher Tuchiyach could apply to. And part of my argument, Ramban was really thinking the way I'm thinking, not only the way you're thinking, is why Ramban takes the trouble to argue with Onkelus and Vayikra. Especially if, as the Bosiyahu points out, you could have learned Pshat and Onkelos without creating that tension. I'm sorry, I'm speaking in shorthand, but I no. Yeah.
It seems explicit from the Ramban that the Navi who does not rebuke Haro is chayav for the mitzvah, for the aver.
Yeah.
Right? What about if the Navi does not warn the people, right? So the Ramban says that he doesn't go through the process of saying first you are, the Navi has to do it. So he does not say, he says specifically that the Navi has to warn the people, but if he does not warn the people, is the Navi also...
In Yecheskel, that's what Yecheskel is saying, that the Navi, or what God is telling Yecheskel, the Navi is fully responsible in that case. So when the Ramban is now explaining Pesukim and Shmot, it implies in the same way that the reason that Moshe had to give Paro these warnings is because that would involve that sense of responsibility. And I then made this further move that why is it a sense of responsibility? Not because of Arevot, so to speak, that we're all responsible together, but because the Navi is, in effect, speaking for God. The Navi is God's face to the world.
And that applies to us today.
Yeah, that there would be, and that
I think in a certain extended way may apply to the way we present Torah today. We present it in a totally pessimistic light, so to speak, where it's all doom and gloom, then in that sense we may really be presenting an incorrect Torah, even if we sort of get all the details right. And even if, you know, life is very, there's a lot of gloom and misery and punishment in life. In a true way, I'm avoiding making a pun on the word choshech now, but said only in that way, maybe distorting Torah, even if we're getting all the details in the right framework. Yeah.
It seems that the whole interpretation of the Ramban about the way that the plagues work and what their purpose was, the idea of Rachamim in general in reference to the Mako, contradicts kind of what seems clear in Torah, the purpose of the Mako, where the purpose wasn't to get Shuva, the purpose wasn't to display mercy, it was to make a show of God's strength. God could have taken the nation out without the Mako. So God says, you know, so that they will recognize that I am God and demonstrate his superiority over them. Yeah. So this whole thing about the mitzvah pressuring Paro to repent and the whole purpose of a private hadrah at all, it seems pointless given what seems to be the clear purpose of the Mako.
It's an excellent question, and the person who's most likely to have asked that question, other than you, is the Ramban. Because you go back to the Ramban, Perek Zayin, the Ramban read the pasuk Bagur Zol Teriti Hamaditicha Lavor Adchad Kfodi Laman Saper Shmi B'chol Aretz. The Ramban did not skip that pasuk, and the Ramban read that pasuk more or less the way you read it. Go back and look at it. So you say, in that case, what's going on? I think the answer is very simple and very profound. The Ramban is really working with two tracks. The fact, we're getting in the second hour somehow, one way or the other. There are two frameworks that are both correct. One framework is all these makot are here to create a spectacle that people remember from generation to generation, etc., etc., etc. However, it is not possible to do that in an unjust way. In order to accomplish that goal, in Achinami, you say the purpose of it all is to create this huge spectacle. But it cannot be done without being fair to Paro and giving him a chance. If you tell me, well, is this what the Ramban would have said? I would say yes, because go back to the Ramban Lech Lecha, page before the other Ramban that I quoted, or page afterwards, I don't remember anymore. The Ramban the Ribbono Shel Olam tells Avram, V'avadum v'inu otam v'achreichen yitzu b'rechush gadol. So it's certainly a scenario of great glory, which has nothing to do with the moral responsibility of the Egyptians, then God tells Abram, V'dor v'yashuvu hena, this will take a few generations, ki lo shalem avon ha'emurid hena. But somehow, despite the fact that there is this important scenario, this manifest destiny of the Jews going to Egypt and leaving Egypt and coming back, the timing of that scenario will be put off or will be determined by the fact that the Amorim, who are now inhabiting Eretz Yisrael, have not yet filled out their measure of sin. They don't yet fully deserve the expulsion. So you see there that Ramban was certainly willing to operate with these two tracks. And I would say here too, he did not forget Perek Zayin when he came to Perek Chet. He simply operated with these two different tracks. You're asking, what's the magnificence of the Makot? You would say, Bavur Zot HaMatich, Bavur Zot Kvuti, Laman Tzapit Shmi B'chol Aretz. At the same time, that cannot be allowed unless Paro is given the same kind of opportunities that you might give other people. At least there's hatra, there is that show of rachamim and concern and willingness to open the dialogue with the sinner.
What you just asked and answered, isn't the track of the justness of it undermined once you get to the point where God is hardening Paro's heart and essentially making a decision for him?
Yes and no.
Well, you've essentially undermined the chance for dialogue.
The question is, what's going on? There are different levels of what goes on when we're dealing with free will. Kind of thing goes on analytic philosophy and these issues. I'll try to put it in simple language to fit the Ramban well. There's the appearance of dialogue and there's the actual likelihood of dialogue. There can be a situation where I know very well that the other person not going to respond to me, but nevertheless it's very important for me to present that framework of dialogue. If the question is, does God care about human beings? The framework may be just as important as the actual outcome. It may be very important that even when Moshe knows, everybody knows that Paro's not going to relent, and that part of Paro's punishment is that his free will is limited, and go back to Perek Zayin, the Ramban defines what is meant at that point, and he does connect it by Vavor Tchad Kvodi. He's different than Rambam in that regard. Nevertheless, it's important that you have this scenario, should be a scenario of warning and response, that the structure of moral experience is not erased at that point. I'm aware that as I officially say, that ends at 10 o'clock, so anybody walks out now, I will not be insulted, and when it comes next year, classes, probably won't remember you, but I will not come in with a negative attitude. Walk out now. Yeah?
Moshe was responsible for telling the Mitzrayim, or telling Paro, is that Maga involving death was going to come. Even more so, probably, he had an obligation to tell the Jews that if something was going to affect them. So shouldn't he have warned about Choshef that millions of them are
going to
die if they didn't do tshuva because they weren't worthy of leaving the tribe at that point?
It's an interesting question. The point, of course, is that the Maror Chazal you're quoting may or may not be pshat in the pasuk. That, it's one problem. We're looking at pshat and drash. Now, how the Ramban deals with Maror Chazal, I don't recall. So that's work for further research. Even if you want to go that way, at this point I'm really talking about something that I haven't researched properly, but I'm not going to sit down now and keep everybody until midnight. Again, I have students come to me for Shabbos, but really do end up point, because that's how these things end up moving from 5 minutes to 2 hours. But if you just want to talk off the top of my head, let's say the people who do not survive Egypt, the Jews who are left behind, it's not so much a matter of punishment, it's just these people not being worthy. And there may be a difference between the two. The feel of Chazal, and again, I may be wrong about this, I'm just recording my gut instincts about something that I haven't looked at lately, is it's not that these people were very wicked people and God took the time of the Choshech to punish them and afflict them and so on and so forth, as much as these were people who really didn't have place within the Knesset Yisrael who were leaving Egypt. And the Ribbono Shel Olam, in effect, had, out of certain considerations of politeness, so to speak, got rid of them when nobody would notice. So it was the timing that would be important. It is not, let's say, like Noach being told, there's a certain period, and if you don't return in that period, then this or that is going to happen. It's a matter of a kind of weeding out process occurring at an earlier point. I think that I'm faithful here to the flavor of the Midrash,
But I can't say it for sure unless you really go back and look at the sources and examine the variations of those sources and then look at exactly what, if anything, the Ramban does to those sources who want to remain within the ambit of the Ramban. But it's certainly something that I am willing to say is I'm giving you a good working hypothesis. And I would be satisfied with it until I have enough time and energy and get over my laziness and actually think about it more. But some of these questions are very good questions because these questions you may not have thought about before and I may not have thought about before. And the more we work on this, the more you realize that if you really read the Ramban carefully, you don't just come up with cute kashas, but you come up with questions that force you to get down to the real grounding in Chumash. So all they communicate, if you don't like anything that I've said, but I communicate a sense that it's important to read the Ramban carefully, and we've had a very successful hour together. One more?
It's like when Navi warns someone, like it's not just the fulfillment of the Navi's kova to give hatorah. There's a hope that the person won't die, that they'll do teshuva, they'll turn away from their evil ways, and then God won't have to kill them anymore. And like so, death is like the end of the road. Like, after death, there can't be the possibility of teshuva anymore. Like that would be why there would be a difference between death and just bad things happen.
That's, you could just say, well, even in worldly terms, leaving aside Shuva, leaving aside anything else, difference between death and an upset stomach is that death is irreversible. And nafkamina may be that, let's say, if you're talking about somebody being injured permanently, you have some pestilence, it wouldn't necessarily kill that many people, but it would. It would have long-range, terrible, worldly consequences. That would not prevent shuva if people are still alive. But it might be the kind of thing that would... So the question would be, what happens if you're talking about people being paralyzed, millions of people being paralyzed for the rest of their lives? Would that count as death in the Ramban's definition? According to you, it would not, because it's in shuva. Or I say that again, it's not like lice, it's not like shin, because it's a temporary kind of thing, and I'm just showing you two ways of reading the question.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much. I really appreciate it.